I just have a question. So you said that the government could do some things to prevent economic downturn and how far we're going to go down. Can you tell us that maybe there's some things we could lobby for that we could encourage, that we could maybe make it start going up again?
Yeah, first of all, just to cut this really short and sweet, if you are interested in a recipe book, in terms of setting the table, a recipe book of how to fix the recession, take a look at www.policyalternatives.ca. On January the 6th, the alternative federal budget process, which is a coalition process, including a lot of your members, some of whom are in this room or were anyway earlier, put together a stimulus package that came in at just like what the International Monetary Fund said, 2% of GDP. And we said how you could spend it to maximize job creation, prevent job loss, and stabilize the incomes of people that are losing their jobs so that we don't get into this kind of downward spiral. You're protecting purchasing power and actually building a platform for getting beyond where we're at right now, which is cyclical, into a platform that is sustainable, resilient, and able to meet the energy, climate change issues, and the inequality issues that are coming up the road, as well as meeting the demand for labor. Because, you know, on January the 1st, 2012, will be the first year that the oldest baby boomer turned 65. So they lost a lot of their retirement savings, but you can bank on the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a sea change in the labor market. We got zero plan on how to deal with that, particularly in service sectors where we have statutory rights like health and education, which is, hey, this is your place. And when Judy was talking about building these ladders for careers, you know, through the union, building up funds to making sure people can move forward, well, you can do that through EI too. You can do that through a number of mechanisms. So the full recipe book for how you can ward off the worst of a recession is on that website, www.policyalternatives.ca. The document that was released on January the 6th, the stimulus plan. But in shorthand, the thing that needs to be done immédiatement is fixing employment insurance. That's the number one thing that is going to make the biggest difference in keeping cash in people's pockets. Not adding 5 weeks at the end, but opening up the doors at the front end. And working with the provinces that have already made huge commitments to poverty reduction strategies, providing assistance to those provinces in the form of affordable housing, in the form of doing, you know, a refundable GIS, increasing the GST credit, the refundable GST credit, improving the child tax benefit, and improving the guaranteed income supplement for seniors. So just keeping money targeted and focused on the bottom of whatever the feds can do directly, which is EI, the GST credit, the guaranteed income supplement, and the child tax benefit. Those four things the feds need no help with, and then they can move to work with the provinces to deliver more childcare, to build more affordable housing, to support them in raising the floor. If we focused all these efforts on raising the floor, not raising the roof, but raising the floor. Well, sometimes raising the floor requires raising the roof, but if we focused on people at the bottom, you can interrupt this spiral. Our package put in 2% of GDP. It generates, according to econometric models, 3% of GDP. Just by the nature of how you pour money in. This package that was just recently introduced by the government in its budget actually protects the rich, does very little for the poor, and ignores the bigger structural issues. All it's trying to do is get us back to, I don't know, summer of 2007, which isn't good enough. You know, it's just like not taking advantage of the opportunity to do what government does best, which is to prepare the way forward.
Merci. Personne au micro 1.
Bon. Microphone 1.
Lisa Bernardo with HEU, and this question is for Armin. First of all, I want to say that you're the first economist I've understood. It's So here's a chance to plug your book. I'm actually going to go out and buy it because I might actually get some of the concepts in that. One of the things I want to talk about is I'm a union trustee on the joint trusteeship for the municipal pension plan. And one of the things that we're facing, and I'm sure a lot of the pension plans in Canada and around the world, is this whole issue of our investments and how that's will be affected by this global crisis. Do you have any words of wisdom in terms of trying to withstand the pressures that we will face, even amongst other unions in the group, of what we need to be doing to ensure our investments or where to put our investments in the future? And I do want to say that in our plan, one of our strategies, we always try to invest in assets as well, including land and stuff, and primarily in Canada. So if you have some words of wisdom on that, I'd appreciate it.
That's a really difficult question, and I appreciate it, though I hate you for asking it. Because it'll show the fissures in my knowledge base. I'm a labor market economist, not a financial market economist. But I do understand a little bit about public finance. What I can tell you right now is that most pension investment structures are geared towards providing a certain rate of return. Those projections are out the window now. We don't know how long we will be dealing with maybe negative rates of return on market investments. The safest bet are GICs, bonds and whatnot, because at least you don't lose your money. Just as a point of comparison, about 6 weeks ago, the American government released $300 billion in treasury bills at 0% interest. Ladies and gentlemen, 0% interest, zero. That is like you get nothing, but you don't lose anything. There was four times as much demand as supply of those bills. People are looking for safe haven. When I say to you, it's not about growth, which is return on investment, it's not about growth, it's about stability, that is absolutely the truth right now. Mind you, we all know that we will move out of this period, whether it's a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, we don't know, but we will move into the next phase of expansion. So I would suggest that you want to not continue to lose ground. You buy whatever treasury bills you can wherever, right? So at least you're not continuing to leak and really pressuring governments to borrow more money, because that's the only way there's going to be more issuances out there. It's a great time for them to borrow to do the things that we need. And it's a great time to provide safe havens for investors. But this government has an allergy to borrowing money, so it needs to be pressured to do that. And there's nothing like buying land. If you're going to buy assets, even though housing prices are going down now, real estate prices are going down now, the cardinal rule of economics 101 is anything that is scarce commands a higher price. Mm-hmm. Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? They're not making more land. So that is going to become in scarcer supply over time. You can get land, and if you've got patient capital, you will receive a gain on it, but only if you sell it. So it is not good enough to just hold assets and see your asset line go up. Eventually, you're going to have to pay that amount of money out. So it depends on how long you're willing to hold the asset. But for the next few years, it looks very bleak indeed.
Merci, Armin. Micro numéro 3, s'il vous plaît.
Microphone number 3.
Listen, 417 Red Deer. I'm originally from BC, so I was kind of a little bit spoiled when I moved to Alberta. I just want to have maybe anyone who wants to answer this question, opinion about what you think of potential coalitions. I know we've got this going on federally. There is a potential of a coalition for at least one election coming up the next time we have one in Alberta. It makes me cringe. And I wonder if there's any opinions on that in regards to getting our agenda through the political process.
Judy?
Well, I guess it depends who's in the coalition, right? there are coalitions that on the right, there are coalitions on the center, coalitions center-left. And obviously, if we can play any role in bringing about a coalition between the center and the left. That's a good thing as far as making gains. I think we have a lot of work to do in this country in educating our own members and the people in general about what coalition politics and coalition governments can be all about, because we were on the verge of one. We were on the verge of one, and the, you know, the splits within the Liberal Party certainly are what's responsible for derailing that, but also there was a lot of backlash. We were talking over, you know, after the session last night with Anne McGrath, who's chief of staff in Jack Layton's office, and we certainly heard it from our members too, huge backlash, because people don't understand about coalitions, and they in particular don't understand the role of the Bloc Québécois. So we could try and say, you know, this is absolutely about a progressive agenda, and the Bloc has a solid history of working and supporting the labor movement and support and working with the NDP on some progressive labor and social policy issues, and that there were significant gains that could be made for working people as a result. But a lot of our members didn't understand that, and we certainly heard about that too. So I think we need to do a lot of education around the issue. I can tell you that when in the 1980s in Ontario, when we were fighting for pay equity legislation with the Equal Pay Coalition and the trade union movement and a broad coalition, we were able to win pay equity legislation because there was it wasn't a formal coalition, but there was an accord between the David Peterson Liberal government and the NDP with Bob Rae, and one of the conditions of the accord that we insisted on and fought for and lobbied for was pay equity legislation, and we achieved pay equity legislation because of that. We also achieved something called successor rights for the cleaners in the office towers in downtown Toronto who have faced exactly the same kind of situation that our workers in long-term care and seniors care experience, the same kind of thing with contracting out support services and flipping contracts. So there are real gains that can be made, but it's critical that we be strong, that we know what our goals are, and that we push all of the parties in power who are potential allies to do the right thing. And doing the right thing is putting the best interests of the people ahead sometimes of narrow partisan interests.
Est-ce que Darlene ou Armin, vous aimeriez rajouter? Non? Alors, je passe la parole.
Microphone number 4, at the back.
Armin, thank you very much for that analysis. You really make very clear to us why you are make us more real how the crisis we are facing. I remember 30 years ago when I came to Canada, the bus ride was 25 cents. Today is $2.30. With $40, I could buy a whole truckload of groceries. Today, I need $500 to buy the same thing. So in nominal terms, I guess we are so depressed, but in the real terms, even worse the picture. And you bring that to us, and really, really appreciate for that. We would call about our opinions about coalitions. I came from a country that we know about coalitions. When coalition came as discussions in our circles, some people were saying that was illegal. It's not illegal. When two parties have not a majority, the parties who want to come together to make a majority, it can be parties have not the whole numbers in the parliament. So having a coalition is one step to go around. But you're right. We had to have a coalition that really advanced our cause. And we had to stop to be apologetic about our positions. We are in the labor movement the vanguard of all the progressive measures that benefit the society as a whole. Don't be apologetic about your position. Be bold and state your agenda at front. Let's be bold together. Put an agenda that will advance the cause for everyone, and don't apologize. and we can make a political straight that will give us what we're looking for without having how to ask like a beggar. We are not the beggars. We are the workers. We own the right. Let's be bold.
Je peux passer la parole au micro.
Microphone number two.
From 998, Winnipeg. And yeah, stop blaming us for the winter, okay? First thing when I got to Montreal, somebody said, oh, we're having a Winnipeg winter. We don't make the weather. We just get it. This is probably for Armin. When I've been looking in the past few years at the financial conditions in North America and Canada and the States, why is it that the banks and the financial institutions and the big corporations are so sacrosanct that it's like they can do what they want and there doesn't seem to be laws, rules, regulations? What is it that they have that they hold this power that they can stymie the whole economy? They could send the whole world into this tailspin. You know, I'm just complaining about the whole thing. Like, how are these politicians with this stupid free trade, which hasn't benefited anybody, as far as I can see, how did we get to this? How did we let this get there? I mean, we're all in this together, and we're all the workers working together, and this conference is called Setting the Table. Now, when you set the table, then you go to the table, and you want to eat. You've got to, you know, you've got to have the bucks, you got to have the dollars in your pocket to go to the store to be able to buy the food. You got to have some kind of transportation to get that food home. You got to have fuel to cook the meal with and to put it on the table to feed your family. And you don't want to go away hungry. You want to go away satisfied. And you want to go away sometimes with dessert. Well, I like that. There was a cartoon about a balanced diet for women, which was a chocolate in each hand. That in any case, I think our rules in Canada are slightly different for banking, which is probably why we didn't have the big mortgage fiasco. But it seems like one huge fiasco in the States after another with lending companies, with the Enron, with all this kind of stuff. I mean, obviously there must be somebody there who sees this coming. And why does no one do anything? I don't understand. Thank you.
I want eye contact. Where'd you go? Just put up your hand. There you are. Okay. No, you can sit down. I just need to know who I'm talking to. There's plenty of blame to go around. It's really easy to say that the banks are the problem, but the banks are the problem because we want dessert first. The unsustainable level of debt that we have going into this problem is why we can't just free up credit and expect things to go back to normal, because the party's over. The debt that we are carrying is because we thought housing prices would go up forever, nobody would lose their job, and interest rates wouldn't go up. Anything that goes up comes down, whether it's a housing price, whether it's interest rates, which are now at 50-year lows. 50 years, the interest rate from the Bank of Canada is now at the level it was when they opened the Bank of Canada in 1934. There is no place but up for it to go. We cannot sustain debt if interest rates go up. We will not be able to sustain our lifestyles if one person loses their job. The story of the last 30 years is that women, you in this room, made the middle class. Why? You left home and you came back into the workplace. It takes two to get into the middle, and it takes two to stay there, and it's getting harder to do that. So one person loses a job, and you are looking at massive lifestyle changes. Because we are living beyond our means. This is not just the banks being overleveraged and greedy, though they are. But it is also us expecting more than our incomes will take and borrowing it from the future, hoping that by the time we get to the future, everything will have caught up with us. Well, the future is now. And it caught up. And it's going to be very ugly for a lot of people. So why didn't people see it coming? You know, nobody likes a Cassandra at a birthday, you know, at a party that says, you know, this is a nice party, but it's going to be over soon. It's like, you're going to ignore the person that is at that party. This was a hell of a party. You are going to shun the people that are saying the sky is going to fall sooner or later. And there were a few people that could read that writing. But, you know, everybody saw a way of making money. And I just want to say about the why didn't anybody see it coming? Well, a few people did. But why didn't we see it coming? Because when you think about it, this goes back to the HEU lady, the pension lady. There is nothing more profound in terms of economic security than our homes. In Canada, we are now at 68% of Canadians owning a home. It's never been higher than that at any point in our history. We used to be more have a lot more renters. Why are people buying homes? Because it's their only financial security. When you've got jobs that you don't know are here today, gone tomorrow. You know, the level of precarious work, you don't know if you can sustain it. You got unaffordable rents, and somebody's coming to you and saying, look, I can give you zero down, 40-year amortization. It's like convert your unaffordable rent to an unaffordable mortgage, and if you need to, you can sell it. Then you got some liquid assets. It's like money in a bank. So we went for it. Stupid idea. We went for it. And we went for it in 2006. It got clawed back to 5% down in 35 years in July of 2008. By the way, this is all happening under Harper. The Bank of Canada and CMHC, the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, was saying, do not go there, baby. And Harper said, like the Bush administration, like the Thatcher administration, the culture of ownership is you're on your own, go take care of yourself. We're not going to give you any income supports, but we'll loosen up the rules. So if you want easy money, we'll make it available to you. And banks want it because, hey, the people that had the money, that actually had steady jobs, well, they're now boomers. Okay, so the next generation of workers are primarily in this precarious employment category. And a lot more poorly paid people, the only way they're ever going to have a house is to have zero down. They can't afford to save any money on what they're making. So the new market for home ownership almost required these crazy money arrangements. So, again, there's lots of blame to go around. For a banking system that does have different regulations than the United States, we didn't do subprimes like, you know, the subprime loan market in the United States were called ninja loans in the middle of the 2000s. Ninja means no income, no job, no assets. We'll give you a loan. Like, no bank in their right mind would give somebody without a job, without income, and without an asset a loan, but there they were doing it because it was almost like a rock-solid proposition that if you have even a certain number of defaults, the investors that would take those mortgages off your hand were guaranteed a certain rate of return, back to the rate of return, sorry, I'm wandering to your point before, that certain rate of return meant you could bundle these mortgages, and yeah, there'd be a few defaults, but the good ones would keep the investors happy, and the banks would write them off their books and let the investors take care of that, right? So everybody, there's blame to be shared by everybody, but everybody was benefiting from this ride. We had governments in both the U.S. and Canada that are allergic to regulations, right? So this moment is, ripely so, not the markets being the solution, but the markets being a problem looking for government solutions, part of which is rules around who can borrow. But let us be very clear about this. When those rules come into place, it will mean fewer people can afford to buy a house. It will not address the structural problem at the bottom, which is that average wages are stagnant and young people are not earning as much as the boomers did at the same age, and that recent immigrants are not moving, are not achieving the income mobility that previous cohorts of recent immigrants saw. So we have a big structural problem in terms of pay, which is why the living wage campaigns, which is any pressure that raises wages, is so important and part of the solution and will not come from government willingly. But government has to be part of that solution, and the only way that's going to happen is if we all form a conga line with our bras and ask for their support. Sorry, maintaining that language that the woman from Manitoba said, not asking for their support, demanding their support.
I'd just like to add that thanks to the New Brunswick sisters, I now have a balanced diet.
Micro numéro trois.
Jennifer. Mic number three.
Vancouver Island, British Columbia, proud member of the Hospital Employees Union, Trillium Local. And on behalf of my local, I would like to we'd like to support our locked out brothers and sisters by donating $100 and having it matched by QP. Thanks.
Merci. Numéro 3 en arrière. Quatre, excusez.
Hi, yes. I actually have a two-part question. I guess you can say it's kind of separate. First one is into regards to the living wage campaign. My name is Poppy Gibson. I'm with I'm a proud member of QP Local 1156, Toronto, Ontario, Toronto Rehab. We have two contracted out services in our hospital, to my knowledge. One is security, and we also have Aramark for a portion of the sites. Trying to get the security side on our side, what I'm talking about joining alliances, because how I look at it is that these guards actually do a lot of work compared, you know, like defending, securing everything. And it's kind of hard for me to actually go up to them and saying, well, you know, what do you think about the campaign? And yes, they are unionized, but it doesn't seem like they're progressing as much from what I've been told. But how would you actually go about getting them to be on your side about, like, trying to get more wages while they're making, like, $13 an hour? And here I am, my pay is at a certain amount as well, which is higher. How would you actually go about that? I would personally like to see them get the same wage as us. The second question that I have has to deal with, I guess you can say, unionized private sector the unionized ones. Do you foresee that some of the private sectors trying to claim bankruptcy or something like that to actually break the union break the union so they can have like their so-called savings? And also I wanted to add that for anyone who is interested in a documentary about the credit crisis, there is a documentary called Maxed Out. And it's really good, and it's a good watch. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good questions. First, on security workers, they also privatized security in British Columbia when they were privatizing laundry and housekeeping and dietary and so on. And we have, some of them were originally our members, some weren't. We have been working hard to organize them. It's tougher because they are very much spread out in a wide variety of locations, even one employer spread amongst sometimes hundreds of sites. So it's a big challenge. But I think the critical thing for building confidence amongst workers that this is a fight worth taking on is having a strategy and being able to talk to people about issues that affect them, but also showing them that there is a possibility of building a case and building a campaign. So when they first privatized our security workers, it's before I was with HEU, I know that the case that the union made repeatedly to the public is that, and to government, is that in a hospital, security people are a vital part of the team. It makes a huge difference when the security person at the front desk or at the front door knows the staff in the facility, knows the patients or the residents, as the case may be. They know what to do in emergencies and who to talk to. They're not employed by an outside company. They're part of a team. So it's really important that we show that we understand the value of their work. And that if we're going to undertake a fight to raise their wages and gain a living wage, that they're going to be front and center in that, and that we've got a strategy to fight smart. Because people are under tremendous pressure. They're very vulnerable. All of these workers employed by contractors are very, very vulnerable. So we have to build their confidence in themselves to take on the fight, but also their confidence in the union, in our ability to take on the fight. As far as these guys declaring bankruptcy, right now these guys are still making money hand over fist. Now that may change, but Compass Corporation, who is the worst corporate citizen in contracting in British Columbia, just announced record profits. And frankly, an operation that involves, in our case, 3,500 workers in British Columbia is a tiny, tiny piece of a global operation where they employ hundreds of thousands of workers, and some of them have made over $1 billion in profits in their record years. So the issue for them is, they say, okay, we took a loss leader, they tell us, in British Columbia in order to get a foot in the market, right? In order to get a foothold. And, we thought we were going to get away with paying $10 an hour because we had a sweetheart deal with another union. Well, those deals got thrown out. They joined the HEU. We negotiated $13 an hour. They're already crying poverty. These guys are making big money. These guys are making big money. But what we ultimately decided was our power is not with those corporations alone. We need to build global movements to take on these corporations together and global campaigns. Absolutely we do. But we also have to take on the fight locally. And in this case, where is it that we have the most ability to put on political pressure? It's public authorities. It's government. It's those places where our taxpayers' money goes and those people we can hold accountable. So when we go and talk to the health authorities or when we went and talked to the Ministry of Health last week, we make all of our arguments. We make the arguments for a living wage. We make the arguments about child poverty and the working poor in this province and in BC and the gap between the rich and the poor. We make the link between low wages, high turnover, and what that means about cleanliness and infection control in an era of superbugs and viruses where these folks ought to be considered a critical part of the team and valued for the work they do, but the lack of training and a high turnover represents a safety risk for them and for patients and residents and the people of BC. And if all else fails, we say to them, we've done polling on this issue, Mr. Health Minister, we've done polling on this issue, and the polling says that 92% of British Columbians believe that anybody who works in healthcare ought to earn a living wage, and 86% believe that no contractor should get any money from any public authority unless they're prepared to pay a living wage. So you can take it one way or you can take it another way. It's about time to pay a living wage.
I'm wondering, Judy, who are the 8% who don't believe that?
obviously liberals.
It's already 5 after noon, 5 after 12, but...
It's already 5 after 12. Micro numéro 2.
Thank you, Sister. Trudy Grebenstein, proud member of QP Local 3550, education workers in Edmonton, Alberta. And I haven't heard a lot of talk about Alberta here today. And I think that a lot of the sisters here may believe what's in the media and believe that we're totally insulated because of our dirty oil and the economy that is supposedly heating up. I will admit that we are insulated from some of the effects of the downturn. But I will tell you that my members can't afford the rent. They're moving their kids in with mom and dad because they can't afford the rent in apartments. They certainly can't afford a home. They have two jobs. They are trying to pay for the milk and the bread in an economy that is so overheated that the prices have gone up. I've gone to the stores here, and when I look at the price of food and the price of some of the necessities of families for the daily table, the prices are lower here. We are paying through the nose to live and survive in a superheated economy. We're not all tied to the oil. We don't all have partners tied to the oil. And we are trying to survive in an economy that is in a downturn. And I am also part of an all-women's bargaining committee and the chief negotiator for my local. I'd like to have my sisters stand. And in view of that, I bring an Alberta Labor History Institute calendar on women and labor, and a bra for the conga line. And this particular bra says, pucker up.
Merci. Thank you so much. Micro numéro 3.
Hi, I'm Rhonda Derby with Local 603 in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. It's about 30 minutes from Dog River and not too far from Woolerton. I just want to say that human rights are not negotiable. Okay. Pay equity is a fundamental human right that should not be traded at the bargaining table. Bill C-10, which is Harper's attack directly on women's rights, needs to be defeated. And I was just hoping somebody that can explain what Bill C-10 is all about to all of us here and do a much better job than what I would. But I think this is a perfect reason why we need a coalition government right now. We need our opposition parties to stop this legislation from going through, because it's going to put us in a situation where if you don't achieve pay equity at that bargaining table, sure, you can go and take them to labor relations, but you could have to do that without the backing from your union, because your union will be subject to a $50,000 fine. So could somebody maybe address that issue?
I read this bill, C-10, just before the conference, and yes, it is a government attack by Harper's government, which is in the omnibus budget presentation, budget law. And the problem is that the opposition, if they vote against the budget, it's a vote of confidence. So in this Bill C-10, talk about the right of women that are attacked. These are the federal employees who had a right, which was difficult to exercise, but they had the right to have a grievance for salary discrimination under the Human Rights Act. The Harper government withdrew this right, saying that this will rather be negotiated at the bargaining table. Now, without saying what should be negotiated, for example, they call this equitable measures, that's what they call it. Now, the unions do not even have the right to encourage their members to complain, because they could be forced to pay an enormous penalty. Now, Harper is saying this is a very proactive measure for equity. It's false. It's a lie. We have to denounce it. We have to put this in our coalition so the coalition should denounce it. I think already there's a movement starting, and some people in CUPE already started to work on this, and we're going to be part of a big coalition to attack this Bill C-10, which is very discriminatory towards women. Is that good enough for the moment? Microphone four.
Boston, Local 1334. I'm privileged to be chair of Ontario University Workers Coordinating Committee. I think it's absolutely brilliant that we've been in this room for hours talking about the economy, talking about economics, and we're not willing to leave because obviously we have some good solutions. One of the things that I wanted to address that hasn't been addressed here this morning, and Judy, you brought it up, talking about the Up With Women's Wages campaign. And I think that as women and the working class, we were conned when we gave up our COLA allowances and turned into accepting percentage wage increases. And we think that we're being treated equal when, you know, the average wage increase is 3%, and none of us take the recognition that 3% on $20,000 and 3% on $100,000 is a huge difference. I'm really privileged to say that at my first time as spokesperson at the bargaining table, I was able to negotiate a cents across the board wage increase for our bargaining unit. The fight was hard because it was hard with those wage earners that were at the top that were our brothers. The fight was also hard because we as women have been conned into we're being treated equal if the number is equal, not figuring out what the dollar value is. So I guess my question is to everybody is how in QP do we revitalize that campaign, Judy, bring up with women's wages back to that we're going across the board and finally getting equality in what we're getting in our wages?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways of raising women's wages, and that's one very important one. And it has been particularly important in raising wages at the bottom of the pay scale. I don't think it's the only tool in our toolbox. I think there are many different ways to do it. And I think one of the... our living wage campaign is absolutely about saying, X amount of dollars across the board, we want to reach a living wage during the life of the collective agreement, and those are definitely flat amounts. I think we have to recognize it's absolutely true that the people at the top of the pay scale in most of our workplaces are predominantly male jobs, and I talked about in our last round of bargaining when there were huge skilled trade shortages in the province of BC, the government was falling, our employers were falling all over themselves to put money into the pockets of skilled tradespeople so they wouldn't leave healthcare and go into the booming construction economy. These days, our skilled tradespeople are saying healthcare's actually looking pretty good. And they're pretty happy to stay. But they got a whopping big increase. But I do think that, and I think many of our workforces have similar challenges. Employers have been very willing to recognize skill levels and qualification levels for predominantly male jobs. They have not been nearly as willing to recognize the kinds of skills and the kinds of educational skills and advanced qualifications that many of the predominantly female jobs within our workforces also have to have in order to do their jobs. So we've had a huge struggle for our employers to recognize the role, and Carol could speak eloquently about it, she was on our bargaining committee and a clerical worker, about the role that clerical workers play and the increased skill and responsibility that they've had to take on and all the new training and things they have to learn in order to play that critical multitasking role that they play, for instance, in the healthcare system. Our licensed practical nurses are working to full scope, taking on more and more responsibilities all the time, but are not being recognized for those advanced skill levels and that increased training, and they're now doing 70% of the work of registered nurses, but earning considerably less. That's an equality issue. That's absolutely an equality issue. So I really think that the issue of raising women's wages and bargaining equality for women is a multifaceted one. Across-the-board increases in some cases, absolutely across-the-board to raise the bottom is absolutely critical, but I think we need a lot of different tools in our toolbox if we're going to do justice to the diverse groups of workers and women that we represent.
Merci. It's 12:15. Please make it short. Micro 2.
Bonjour à tous. Je suis très heureux.
I'm very happy to be here today for someone like me after all that I put up with in my work, I'm now among women and I'm proud to be here, very proud. Personally, I'm at the moment fighting in the workplace. I'm working against to have a better life and to be able to talk with other people, to have some hope in Quebec, hope in Canada. I have three jobs and that's no life for anybody. Three jobs is no life for anybody. I had to drop my studies in order to pay to keep orphans alive in Haiti. But this is no life for anybody. Three jobs and dropping your studies. The government's talking about all kinds of promises, okay? Now, as far as rents are concerned and loans, look, I'm not stupid. I didn't get a loan to buy a house. There were six of us in a little four-room apartment. And I asked for assistance. No assistance. They don't want to give me any help. So the little bit amount of money that I can earn, 25% of my salary was cut back. And I couldn't pay the electricity. So every time they come back and they're trying to get more and more money out of us, what am I going to live with? What am I going to live with? Thank God. Thank God. He's not looking at my body, but he's looking at my heart. When they're looking at me, they'll think I got a lot of money. I get by with what I have in order to help these orphans in Haiti. That's my choice, to help to save these kids. But women do this, don't they? Let's fight together. Let's fight together. We're going to fight against the government so that we can get decent jobs and a living wage. Micro 3?
2316, Children's Aid Society of Toronto. Just a couple of comments. One, we're seeing a major corporatization of our agency. We are a publicly funded nonprofit organization that provides child protection services. Our board has now closed meetings to the stakeholders, including the union. So we're no longer able to hear what they're talking about. We're no longer able to partake in conversations. We are going to deal with this, and we are fighting back because we disagree. You don't shut us out when you talk about transparency. It's not the same thing. Our sister local in Windsor, the Windsor CAS, they have been approached by their management to open up their contract. They want to roll back wages. They want to roll back benefits. And then they want to freeze them. And their local has said, no way, get lost. We have a contract. You honor it. Now they're trying to go and close one of their satellite offices because that's how they want to save money. They have not put on the floor that they want to cut back the senior management or the benefits and pay of their senior leadership. And finally, in regards to pay equity, we just finished doing that after about 2.5 years of job evaluation and redoing our pay equity. And what we realized and what we managed to negotiate this time was also internal equity. Because as Janice spoke earlier, what the people were making at the bottom and what we're making at the top, 3% is vastly different, and we were finding out that we had almost 11% difference in pay between steps in our grids, between the classifications. And that's not okay. And so part of it has become for us the whole education of our members around what 3% means for one person versus another, and making it a solidarity issue to support our lower paying members. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Ne quittez pas, s'il vous plaît. On a des annonces à faire et j'ai demandé.
Don't run away, don't run away. We have a few announcements here. Carol from BC has a few words to say to thank our conferencers, our speakers this morning, and then we have a few announcements.
Well, I think it's been another pretty fabulous, energizing morning at the CUPE National Women's Bargaining Conference. What do you guys think? So if I could have our panelists come up to the mic here. You know, as I listened to these three women speak this morning, the saying, knowledge is power, kept coming to my mind. And I think we can all agree that as a result of having Armin, Darlene, and Judy share their knowledge with us this morning, that we will all be more powerful when we head back to fight for women's equality, both in our communities and at our bargaining tables. So on behalf of the National Union and the CUPE National Women's Committee, I want to thank you all for being a part of our panel this morning.